KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Good morning. Why did it take so long to get a deal between Israel and Hamas that was actually on the table months ago? We ask a former diplomat in this hour of Morning Edition from NPR News. It's almost a cliche at this point to describe the U.S. as divided. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Leila Fadel. So instead, we're bringing you the story of an unexpected moment of connection in our series on Seeking Common Ground. The winds that stoked the wildfires in Los Angeles are finally calming, but life is not normal. So much has been lost, and kids haven't been in school for more than a week. We hear from young people craving stability. It's Thursday, January 16th. Actress, director, and producer Regina King is 54 today. News is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Senate confirmation hearings are underway for several of President-elect Trump's nominees. They include former Congressman Lee Zeldin. He's been tapped to be the next administrator for the Environmental Protection Agency. Zeldin says he is committed to upholding the EPA's mission of ensuring clean air and water.
I will foster a collaborative culture within the agency, supporting career staff who have dedicated themselves to this mission. I strongly believe we have a moral responsibility to be good stewards of our environment for generations to come.
Other nominees with hearings today include billionaire money manager Scott Bessent for Treasury Secretary, and Trump's pick for Attorney General Pam Bondi is facing questions for a second day. Florida Senator Marco Rubio is expected to be confirmed as the next Secretary of State. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis has just announced Rubio's successor as U.S. Senator. He's tapped Florida Attorney General Ashley Moody for the job. A vote in the Israeli cabinet to implement a ceasefire agreement in Gaza has been delayed. As NPR's Kat Lonsdorf reports, that's after the deal's mediators, the U.S., Egypt, and Qatar, announced an agreement had been struck.
Israel says that Hamas has gone back on several parts of the agreement at the last minute, according to a statement from the prime minister's office. It said that the prime minister has indefinitely postponed convening the cabinet to vote until all details are agreed upon. The deal has to be approved by Israel's government before a ceasefire can go into effect. In a statement on the group's Telegram channel, Hamas denied it had created obstacles, saying it was, quote, committed to the ceasefire agreement announced by the mediators. Two far-right members of Netanyahu's cabinet have been very vocal about opposing the deal, threatening to leave the government if Israel agrees to it, a move that could topple Netanyahu's coalition. Kat Lonsdorf, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
California fire officials say there is progress fighting some of the deadly Los Angeles area wildfires. The Eaton Fire in the Pasadena-Altadena area is now more than half contained. NPR's Kirk Siegler reports researchers at UCLA say the wildfires are more catastrophic because of climate change.
UCLA climate scientists are linking climate change to the extreme dryness in the Chaparral Hills in and around Los Angeles. Their research shows that when the brush fires ignited last week, vegetation was 25% drier than it would have been without factoring in climate change. Scientists say these fires would have still been dangerous, but maybe not quite as big, or have seen the intensity or rapid growth. This marks a change in communication lately in the scientific community, which had shied away from tying any one disaster to climate change. But scientists now are pinning specific events like heat waves, hurricanes, and fires directly to rising global temperatures as a result of human activity. Kirk Sigler, NPR News.
On Wall Street, the Dow was down nearly 40 points. You're listening to NPR. A new study suggests that eating red meat in large quantities can increase your risk of dementia and cognitive decline. Researchers published a study in the journal Neurology. They found that among the people they studied, those who ate 3/4 of an ounce of processed red meat at least once daily had a 13% higher risk of developing dementia. That's compared to people who ate a minimal amount. Replacing one serving of red meat daily with nuts and legumes was associated with a 19% lower risk of dementia. Ancient DNA has revealed that during the Iron Age, women in an ancient Celtic society were at the center of their social network, unlike previous eras. Ari Daniel prepared this report.
For much of human history, societies have been centered around kinship, so couples have had to decide whose community they're going to live with. Most of the time, it's been the man's, which is why researchers were surprised when they sequenced the ancient DNA of a burial site of a Celtic tribe dating from 100 BCE to 100 CE in what's now southern England. The group was related along the female line, meaning that the men had left their families to live with their wives' community. Laura Cassidy is a geneticist at Trinity College Dublin.
The women, they're embedded in a much wider network, so they have a much greater support system.
The same thing was true among hundreds of Iron Age genomes from cemeteries across Britain, suggesting it's a custom dating back centuries. For NPR News, I'm Ari Daniel.
And I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Lilly Endowment, a private foundation supporting NPR's coverage of religion and spirituality, and Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Faldin.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Good morning. In a few minutes, we will hear about the speech last night that was likely Joe Biden's last official address as president.
First, though, there are questions about whether a ceasefire announced by the U.S. between Israel and Hamas will actually go into effect on Sunday. Here's Biden announcing it.
This deal was developed and negotiated under my administration, but its terms will be implemented, for the most part, by the next administration. In these past few days, we've been speaking as one team.
But as we speak, there are questions on whether it will happen at all. Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has delayed a cabinet meeting that was scheduled to vote on the deal today. He says Hamas has gone back on key demands. Hamas denies this. Meanwhile, two far-right ministers in Netanyahu's government are threatening to collapse the government over the deal. Aaron David Miller joins me now. He's senior fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace and a former peace negotiator in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Good morning.
Good morning, Lou. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for being here. With this news, Aaron, does this make you think this deal might be dead?
Dead? No, not dead, but it does reflect, I think, the reason it took so long to actually negotiate this deal. You know, Henry Kissinger once quipped that Israel had no foreign policy, only domestic politics. And the reality is, even though there are no rewind buttons on history, this deal could have been concluded four months ago. The basic framework is the same. The reason it wasn't, primarily, I think, is because the organizing principle of Benjamin Netanyahu's world is to stay in power, and he prioritized quote-unquote total victory over Hamas, which he has not succeeded in attaining, rather than returning the hostages. And he's got these two ministers threatening to collapse the government. There's no question about it. One of them, Itamar Ben-Gavir, basically bragged that he was the reason that the deal hadn't been included until now. So the same basic logic, Leila, is at work here. I suspect the cabinet will approve it, but too many uncertainties abound, and we haven't even started implementation.
Well, let's talk about the actual deal itself. It's a phased approach. As I understand it, this is just a pause at this point, the first phase, and the other phases will still be negotiated. Can this lead, this deal, lead to an actual end to the war?
It could, if in fact you had leaders on both sides and an American administration willing to spend the time and effort to help the parties implement it. But the second phase is going to be very tough because it requires Hamas to basically free all the remaining hostages, roughly, 40 to 50 living and dead Israeli soldiers in exchange for a permanent end to the war and the withdrawal of Israeli forces from Gaza. And no Israeli government is going to withdraw from Gaza without guarantees of some follow-on security force. So the first phase, 42 days, I think we need to focus, frankly, on whether or not that can be implemented. And I think it's certainly possible, but it's going to take a lot of will and skill, and again, from the incoming administration. Donald Trump now owns this, and he's going to have to spend the time on it, otherwise it's going to crater.
Now, this is if it happens at all, and we've heard from lots of people that they felt the deal might happen Sunday because President-elect Trump is coming into office and has threatened that hell would be paid if a deal wasn't done. Is that the reason?
I think that's a factor. Hamas is weakened because of what the Israelis have done to Hezbollah. Even the Iranians can't put much stock or faith in their so-called axis of resistance. So that's clearly a factor. But there's no doubt that the incoming administration, which has the power, and the outgoing administration, which doesn't, again, in Benjamin Netanyahu's calculations, it's much harder for him to say no to Donald Trump, given his interests, than it was to Joe Biden. So, yeah, I think the Trump factor played a role here.
What is the U.S. role going forward? I mean, at this point, it's unclear if this is going to happen by Sunday, but if it does go into effect, what will the U.S. role, as you said, President-elect Trump will own this?
Well, you've got a set of detailed requirements on each side that need to be implemented. The U.S. doesn't have relations with Hamas, clearly. That's going to fall to the Egyptians and the Qataris. So working with the Israelis, using incentives and perhaps disincentives. But if the Israelis aren't committed to the first phase, no amount of pressure from the Trump administration is going to see this through. We have to just hope that Israeli politics here will play in favor of supporting the deal, because the vast majority of the Israelis want the hostages home, even though this is isn't a partial deal. So again, nobody ever lost money betting against Israeli-Palestinian peace, but I'm thinking this has a reasonable chance to move forward, and then we'll see about whether or not you can actually end the war in Gaza.
But if, as you describe, the prime minister is in a situation where it's not in his political interest to have this deal, then does it happen? I mean, if it goes through, there could be elections. There is an arrest warrant out for Benjamin Netanyahu by the International Criminal Court for the war in Gaza. Israel also faces a case of genocide at the International Court of Justice. I mean, is there a true interest in getting to this deal?
I think there is an interest in moving through phase one. I don't think even Benjamin Netanyahu focuses on his own political survival, could not have entered into this particular agreement. And then, of course, you have Hamas's equities in this. I mean,
yeah.
Does Hamas know where all the hostages are? Are they being truthful with respect to those that are living or dead? So you've got two combatants here who fundamentally don't trust one another and who are actually dedicated in one another's destruction, trying to implement a very complicated deal which requires an enormous amount of discretion and trust. I worry about the fact that there's no monitoring. There doesn't appear to be an implementation mechanism here, and that could prove very difficult. But again, if the Israeli cabinet approves this, I think there's a reasonable chance you'll get through phase one. The problem is going to be after the first 6 weeks and whether Hamas and Israel will agree basically to end the war, free all the hostages. That's the real challenge.
Aaron David Miller is a senior fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace and a former Mideast peace negotiator. Aaron, thank you for your time.
Thanks for having me, Lila.
Now to Joe Biden's farewell speech from the Oval Office last night, his final goodbye after 50 years in public office. The president spoke about his legacy, but also had a warning for the nation. NPR White House correspondent Asma Khalid was watching, and she's with us now to tell us more about it. Good morning, Asma.
Good morning, Michelle.
So let's start with this warning. What did the president say concerns him so deeply?
Biden said he's gravely concerned about what he sees as a concentration of power in the hands of a few ultra-wealthy people, and he warned that there could be dangerous consequences if that power is left unchecked.
Today, an oligarchy is taking shape in America of extreme wealth, power, and influence that literally threatens our entire democracy.
And Michelle, I'm sure you noticed that word, oligarchy. I mean, it is an incredibly strong term to use. This is the first time that he's used it in an American context. When I've heard him reference that word before, it's usually been about, you know, corruption in Russia or Ukraine. But Biden said he's worried about powerful forces rolling back his climate measures, for example, for their own interest, referencing there to the concentration of wealth and power.
You know, it's worth pointing out that one of Trump's closest advisors has become Elon Musk, a tech entrepreneur. He's currently the wealthiest man in the world, and it's noted that a number of these tech billionaires will have places of honor at his inauguration on Monday. Did Biden name any of these ultra-rich people that he says he's worried about?
Nope, he did not. He did single out the tech industry, saying he's concerned about the potential rise of a, quote, tech industrial complex. Last week, Mark Zuckerberg, the CEO of Meta, which is the parent company of Facebook and Instagram, announced it's ending its fact-checking operation. And last night in his speech, Biden called out that idea.
Social media is giving up on fact-checking. The truth is smothered by lies told for power and for profit. We must hold the social platforms accountable.
And Biden said he's worried about misinformation, the concentration of power, technology, and wealth he thinks could lead to more division amongst Americans. But, Michelle, I also want to point out that to me, as someone who has covered Biden's 2020 presidential campaign and then, you know, 4 years of his administration, it was genuinely surprising to hear this idea of an oligarchy as his primary warning to the American public on his way out the door. You know, in the past, he has spoken about the dangers he sees from Donald Trump. He has singled him out as a threat to democracy, authoritarianism. He said in 2020 that he ran to save the soul of the nation. But we didn't hear a whole lot of that last night. He didn't once call out the president-elect by name.
Interesting. Did he talk about his successor at all, perhaps indirectly?
You know, he began his remarks with news of the ceasefire and hostage deal in Gaza. That's something that the president-elect Donald Trump is trying to take credit for. Biden made sure to say that it was his own plan, even though he did acknowledge it'll largely be implemented by the incoming administration. You know, but to the point about the warning bells he had previously rung about Trump, those were more subtle. He said at one point that the Constitution needs to be amended to make it clear that no president is immune from crimes they commit in office. And he spoke about the courage to stand up to the abuse of power. He spoke a lot about his idea of America, an America that respects institutions. But broadly, he said he wishes the incoming administration success because he wants America to succeed.
Look, it's a tough time for Democrats. The president's approval, President Biden's approval rating is underwater. Democrats lost the November election. They lost control of both the House and the Senate. I was curious about how Biden tried to frame his legacy.
Yeah, he spoke at length about some of the legislation he's passed.
It will take time to feel the full impact of all we've done together. But the seeds are planted, and they'll grow and they'll bloom for decades to come.
You know, Biden spearheaded major investments in things like semiconductors, clean energy, and infrastructure, but it will take years for that to be felt, and Biden personally may never see the political benefit of those investments.
That is NPR's Asma Khalid. Asma, thank you.
My pleasure.
This is NPR News.
on the next Fresh Air. For years, it was thought that a Chicago police sergeant created the rape kit, a tool for investigating sexual assault and rape that has been instrumental in getting justice for victims. Investigative reporter Pagan Kennedy will tell us about the real creator, an activist who worked with runaway youth in the 70s. Join us.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, supporting creative people and effective institutions committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information is at macfound.org. From Cunard, offering travelers an opportunity to voyage aboard Cunard's Queen Elizabeth to Alaska. Guests can experience Glacier Bay National Park and Hubbard Glacier, as well as locally sourced cuisine. Learn more at cunard.com. From BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 35,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Leila Faldin. As we hear a lot about divisions in this country, let's listen to a moment of unexpected connection. It comes from a recent conversation in San Francisco as part of our series, Seeking Common Ground, at member station KQED brought together a small group of people to talk about one of California's most vexing issues, housing affordability. California has some of the highest property values in the country and the largest share of unhoused residents. In the room for this conversation was a man struggling to afford housing and a woman who is a landlord.
My name's Nancy Breyer. I have four properties. The biggest property that we have is six units. So, you know, really small time landlords. We sort of know all of our tenants, you know, so I've been doing this for 30 years now and have really seen every kind of housing situation that you can think of.
Luis Edwin Sanchez, born and raised in San Francisco. I'm 62 years old, journeyman union carpenter, retired. Had to take early disability retirement a couple years ago and had a pretty decent life until I got hurt and things changed dramatically. But yeah, so I know what the people who are sleeping on the city streets in tents right now are going through because I've been there three times. And I'm not happy to say that it's a very good possibility it may happen again. I'm currently on the Section 8 wait list for a voucher. It'll probably take me another 10 years if I live that long. I mention that because of how huge the need is.
Can I say one quick thing? My last Section 8 tenant just moved, and that family was in this unit for 9 years. And I'm very happy that we were able to provide them with nice housing for all that time. But I swear when that family moved out, I could hear the angels singing. I have another tenant I've had for over 20 years. The piece of paper that we have with our rental agreement is one side of one page. And for the Section 8 family that we housed, I have boxes and boxes and boxes of papers. It was insane. So, you know, maybe the reason that you can't find a Section 8 house, which I wish you could, is because the system makes it too hard for somebody like me to give it to you.
It is extremely stupid the way the Section 8 system is set up, because now I know what a person like you, a smaller landlord, has to deal with. Well, hello, it's the same thing for us too. It was no fun for me to have to fill out a stack this big of paperwork just to get into this stupid place that I'm in right now. I was homeless at the time that I was going through all this. So I was walking around with a backpack with a whole heck of a lot of my belongings in. It weighed about 50 pounds. Not only did she want me to fill out a stack this thick of paperwork, but she also wanted this document. She also wanted that document. And I said, lady, I'm homeless. Me and the gentleman that I'm roommates with right now, we literally for about a whole week had to run all over San Francisco getting all these different documents and this, that, and the other, proof of this, proof of that. It was a pain in the rear end, and it needs to be streamlined. Wave a magic wand, build a heck of a lot more housing, and make sure that that housing, once it's built, can be afforded by people who are poor.
If I could wave the magic wand, I would want the government to make renting housing less risky for small-time landlords. How can we provide housing that isn't crazy expensive? And one of the ways to do that is for somebody like Ed not to have to fill out a phone book worth of forms, and for me as the landlord not to have to fill out an entire document box of forms. There could be more eloquent solutions that we could all agree with, and that would result in somebody having a better place to live, the landlord having a better experience, and the community being more at peace.
That was Nancy Breyer and Ed Sanchez of San Francisco from a conversation hosted by KQED's Ki Sung and Aaron Baldessari. This story is part of a partnership with Cortico. That's a nonprofit affiliated with MIT that uses AI tools to identify shared themes in conversations. In keeping with NPR policy, AI played no role in the recording or editing of what you just heard.
Lil Baby and Bad Bunny, does that sound like a kid's book to you? Well, no. Those two rappers just made huge debuts on this week's Billboard Albums chart. Stephen Thompson of NPR Music has this report.
Lil Baby enters the chart on top with the album Wham. That's an acronym for Who Hard Is Me, not a tribute to the duo who spent last Christmas in the top five. Wham becomes the rapper's fourth consecutive chart topper. Lil Baby and his team pulled out all the stops to make sure the album hit number one. It's loaded with guest appearances. It came out on the first Friday in January. That's traditionally a soft spot when it comes to new music. And then it got extra juice from an extended edition just 4 days later. Those machinations were necessary for topping the chart because another superstar dropped an album around the same time. Bad Bunny's Debí Tirar Más Fotos outperformed Wham on streaming services, even though it was released 2 days after Lil Baby's album. But Bad Bunny couldn't match Lil Baby's first week sales numbers. With Lil Baby at number one and Bad Bunny at number two, the new year in music is finally starting to shape up and push some of the stagnation of 2024 off the top of the charts. Stephen Thompson, NPR Music.
This is NPR News.
4 years ago, President Biden made closing Guantanamo Bay's prison in Cuba a goal. But now that looks unlikely to happen, disappointing those who consider Gitmo a national embarrassment.
Man, I mean, especially now that President Biden's a lame duck, I don't understand the politics of this at all.
The political and legal barriers to closing Guantanamo Bay, on All Things Considered, from NPR News.
Live from NPR News, I'm Lakshmi Singh. The U.S. Senate is holding another day of confirmation hearings on President-elect Trump's nominees. They include Scott Bessent for Treasury Secretary and Lee Zeldin to oversee the Environmental Protection Agency. Lawmakers will also hear witness testimony on Pam Bondi, nominated for Attorney General. She testified yesterday, as did Senator Marco Rubio, who was nominated for Secretary of State. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis has selected State Attorney General Ashley Moody to serve out the remaining 2 years of Rubio's term in the Senate. The Republican describes Moody as someone who mirrors his administration's values.
She's also rejected DEI, ESG, gender ideology, and supported our efforts to ensure Florida's education is free from impositions of the radical left.
The Israeli cabinet is delaying its vote on a ceasefire with Hamas in Gaza. Despite this, leaders around the globe are applauding the tentative agreement widely announced yesterday. NPR's Lauren Frayer has more from London.
UK Prime Minister Keir Starmer calls it long overdue news. In a statement, he paid tribute to British citizens killed by Hamas and called for a two-state solution and a huge surge of humanitarian aid into Gaza. His Foreign Secretary David Lammy also said we're in a, quote, moment of hope after a year of agony.
NPR's Lauren Frayer reporting. You're listening to NPR News. The Supreme Court's considering arguments surrounding a free speech-related challenge to a Texas law. The state requires pornographic sites to verify users' age before granting access to sexually explicit content. Here's NPR's Jacqueline Diaz.
The Supreme Court is weighing whether a Texas law that makes adults verify their ages in order to access sexually explicit material online is unconstitutional. Opponents say the law is overly vague, violates protections for free speech, and unfairly places burdens on adults. Texas and supporters of the state law say those so-called burdens don't exist. And they say age verification tools are common and offer much-needed protection for kids. Texas passed their law in 2023, and already more than a dozen states have their own versions of the law, some of which are facing similar legal challenges. Jacqueline Diaz, NPR News.
As Boeing's two astronauts wait to hitch a ride back home with a rival commercial space company, one of them, Sunny Williams, went on a spacewalk today for the first time since she arrived on the International Space Station 7 months ago. On repair duty, Williams got a close-up look at the SpaceX capsule that is now scheduled to carry her and her colleague, Butch Wilmore, to Earth this spring. Both astronauts were supposed to be at the ISS for only a week, but problems with Boeing's new Starliner delayed return plans. It's NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on thinkorswim. Learn more at schwab.com. From Indeed, designed to be an end-to-end hiring solution for businesses of all sizes to attract, interview, and hire candidates all from one platform. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. And from the Public Welfare Foundation, committed to advancing transformative youth and criminal justice reforms.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Faldin.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Good morning. Los Angeles is waking up to a reprieve, though Santa Ana winds yesterday were not as bad as feared. But with schools still closed after more than a week of wildfire chaos, kids are struggling. Many have lost their homes, and they are craving stability. NPR's Janaki Mehta has been talking with young people in L.A. and is with us now to tell us more. Good morning, Janaki.
Good morning, Michelle.
So, of course, I want to hear about your conversation with the kids. But first, would you just bring us up to speed on the status of efforts to battle these wildfires?
Yeah, so for much of yesterday, everyone in LA was just anxiously bracing for high winds that could have fueled the fires, but things stayed relatively calm. And the good news is that the red flag warnings that were in place yesterday have expired. Fire crews have made more progress containing two of the biggest fires, so the Palisades to the west and the Eaton to the east. And forecasters also expect some moisture in the air Friday and into the weekend, which could really help firefighters make more headway. Now, the downside is another round of fast-moving winds could be back Sunday night and last into next week. So the next couple days are crucial, but full containment could take weeks.
So let's hear about your conversations with folks, especially kids. How are they managing?
Yeah, this has been really hard on kids who just went through the pandemic not that long ago. It's, you know, another disruption to their education. Yesterday, I met up with 15-year-old Abel Rivera. His family lost their longtime rental home in Altadena. And after evacuating, they all had to spread out in different directions. You know, some are at a temporary Airbnb, some are with different family members. It's been really hard on Abel to be separated and to have lost almost everything.
15 years of my life is basically gone. Everything that I've accomplished, every single medal I have, every single collection, everything I had is gone.
And Michelle, one of Abel's most prized pet medals was from when he finished running the LA Marathon last year when he was just 14. He told me he lost his running shoes in the fire too. And, you know, he's grateful everyone in his family made it out alive, but he told me he's really just missing the simple things right now, like hanging out with his friends at school.
I can imagine. But Jackie, what about the schools in LA? Have any of them reopened since the fires began last week?
Yeah, so LAUSD, which is the country's second largest public school district, reopened most of its schools on Monday, except, of course, the ones that are closest to the Palisades fire and are, you know, still in the mandatory evacuation areas. But Abel and another student I met, Indy Rothman, actually belong to Pasadena Unified School District on the east side, and school is closed for them at least through the end of this week. Here's what 12-year-old Indy told me.
I'm missing routine, to be honest. I'm supposed to be getting my grades up and stressing out not about this fire, instead about my grades and all that stuff. And it's confusing to my mind and my body because it's unexpected.
Indy's family is displaced right now, like thousands of others here. Their home is still standing, but it's likely damaged, and most of the houses surrounding their block are completely gone. So, yeah, she says this whole time has reminded her of the pandemic, and she cannot wait to be back at school.
So, of course, people are eager to get back to their homes and check on things. Any sense of when they will be allowed to return?
Yeah, it's the big question. It's hard to say. Evacuation orders are being lifted in some neighborhoods, and officials say they realize folks are keen to get back and see what's left of their homes, but they want to make sure it's safe to do that, and they keep stressing it's going to take some time.
And Janaki Mehta reporting from Los Angeles. Janaki, thank you.
Thank you, Michelle.
Many of President-elect Trump's economic promises involve tariffs. NPR White House correspondent Daniel Kurtzleben reports they could be hard or even impossible to keep.
According to Donald Trump, tariffs can do all sorts of good.
The word tariff, properly used, is a beautiful word. One of the most beautiful words I've ever heard. It's music to my ears.
On the campaign trail, he said tariffs could raise revenue.
And we will take in hundreds of billions of dollars into our treasury and use that money to benefit the American citizens.
He also said tariffs would boost U.S. manufacturing. Trump said he'd impose tariffs on cars made in Mexico.
The only way they'll get rid of that tariff is if they want to build a plant right here in the United States with you people operating that plant.
At a recent press conference, he also said tariffs could stem illegal immigration and drugs.
We're going to put very serious tariffs on Mexico and Canada, because Canada, they come through Canada too, and the drugs that are coming through are at record numbers.
It sounds great. One simple trick to tackle fentanyl, debt, and jobs. But economists say tariffs just can't do all of that, especially not simultaneously. Here's Erica York, Vice President of Federal Tax Policy at the Tax Foundation, a right-leaning economic think tank.
You can have a tariff for revenue, or you can have a tariff for restriction, but you can't have both.
To get super basic, a tariff is a tax that American importers pay for goods from other countries. So, yes, tariffs do bring in some revenue. Except, Trump also wants tariffs to boost manufacturing. The idea here is to make, say, foreign cars more expensive, meaning Americans would buy fewer foreign cars. But if Americans buy fewer foreign cars, tariff revenue goes down. And that's not the only contradiction York sees in Trump's policy. If a Trump tariff threat succeeds in getting Canada or Mexico to crack down on drugs, it wouldn't raise revenue or protect American workers.
The way the incoming Trump administration is talking about it is that they can have their cake and eat it too, but that is just not the case.
Trump's tariff proposals go way beyond what he imposed in his first term. He has floated tariffs of up to 60% on Chinese goods, plus a proposed 25% on Canada and Mexico. He has even suggested a blanket 10 to 20% on all imports. And this week on social media, Trump once again suggested that tariffs would not only raise revenue, but replace other tax revenue. He has often pointed to the 19th century, before the federal income tax, as an era he admires.
It'll make our country rich. You go back and look at the 1890s, 1880s, McKinley, and you take a look at tariffs, that was when we were at our proportionately the richest.
To be clear, many experts say it would be impossible to boost tariff revenue the way Trump wants. After all, last year, tariffs accounted for just 2% of government income. Kimberly Clausing is one of those experts. She's at the Peterson Institute for International Economics and worked at the Biden Treasury Department. She adds that tariffs will also raise prices, while at the same time, higher-income people would be helped by Trump's proposed tax cuts.
I think a cynical reading of what the Trump administration is suggesting is a bunch of regressive tax cuts that help those at the top of the distribution that are paid for with the regressive consumption tax that's going to hit the poor the hardest.
NPR asked the Trump team to explain how tariffs can accomplish all of Trump's stated goals. They didn't answer specifically, saying instead that tariffs will protect American manufacturers and workers. When Trump takes office next week, he'll have the opportunity to show Americans just how far he's prepared to go with this strategy. Danielle Kurtzleben, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
Panama's president is trying to stop U.S.-bound migrants from trekking through the Darien Gap. That includes troops, razor wire, and deportations. Next time in Here and Now.
You wait for the bus, you wait for the weekend, your morning coffee to finish brewing, but you don't have to wait to get live news from NPR. Go to this station's website or npr.org on your phone.
Good morning, I'm Leila Fadel. Last week, Lebanon's parliament voted for a president. When the speaker was tallying votes, one name confused him.
Bernie Sanders.
That's right, Bernie Sanders, or as he's referred to among some Arabs, Ammu Bernie, which means Uncle Bernie, got a vote for president of Lebanon. But he's not a citizen or a Maronite, so he was later removed from the tally. Guess his future is still in the U.S. Congress. It's Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from this station
And from the Lodestar Foundation, inspired by the principle that helping someone else less fortunate is a path to a happier, healthier, and more meaningful life. Learn more at lodestarfoundation.org. From Eric and Wendy Schmidt, through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working toward a healthy, resilient, secure world for all. On the web at theschmidt.org. And from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Faldin.
And I'm Michelle Martin. The U.S. stock market saw big gains in 2024. And in fact, the last 15 years have been pretty incredible for the market. Does that mean investors should put all their eggs in the U.S. stock market basket? Here are NPR's Darian Woods and Adrian Ma from our Planet Money podcast, The Indicator.
Looking at the earnings of U.S. companies, on average, they have made out handsomely. Now, critics will say a lot of that is concentrated in just a handful of tech companies. Also, they point out that the U.S. government deficits might be juicing the economy temporarily.
Regardless, how much money these companies are making doesn't tell the full picture. Dan Villalon is a principal at AQR Capital Management.
As the U.S. has outperformed, it has also become more expensive.
So take Amazon, for example. At the start of 2024, the share price was around $150. Now, towards the end of the year, it was around $230. Amazon may be extremely profitable over the next 10 years, but a lot of people already think that. So when someone invests in Amazon now with that high share price, it's not as good a deal as it used to be. And that's where one investing magic trick comes in: diversification.
Not having all of your eggs in one basket is a great way to build a portfolio that's likely to hold up better.
Diversification also means investing in lots of different industries, plus lots of countries. Maybe one year the US goes into recession, but Japan doesn't. Diversifying which countries people invest in would protect against losing a chunk of their savings.
Diversification is famously or maybe infamously called the only free lunch in finance.
And the free lunch is this. You've heard the expression higher risk, higher reward. And that is basically how markets work. Riskier industries, riskier countries, more chances to lose, but possibly a better return on investment when things go well. Now, if someone is diversified, they can still get some of those higher rewards while being insured. So if one company fails, another might do well. So it's a low risk, high-ish reward, but there is a cost.
Psychologically, mentally, the lunch may be free, but it's not easy to consume.
I mean, yeah, it's like you could have a perfectly balanced, healthy lunch, but is it really as fun as just like housing an entire bag of chips?
Yeah, a bag of chips is pretty easy to wolf down. And so what he's saying is that when an investor has a diversified portfolio, there can be this kind of FOMO. Well, Dan says those thoughts can tempt investors away from diversification. And that brings us back to why it's particularly tempting now to stick with only U.S. stocks, even though Dan cautions otherwise.
The U.S. has become pricey. And other markets, you know, even though they are less loved, may be offering a better deal over the next 5 to 10 years. I would never say, you know, to get out of a market altogether, but I would use that as an encouragement to get folks to diversify a little better across all.
In some ways, if someone's been heavily investing in U.S. tech stocks recently, it must feel like they've stumbled upon a gold mine. So why would they pack up and explore elsewhere?
Leaving when the party's just getting good can be hard. But Dan says it can be wise to have other options for when things start to get messy. Darian Woods,
Adrian Ma, NPR News.
Support for Planet Money comes from Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on Thinkorswim. Learn more at schwab.com.
This is NPR News. This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Leila Fadel. Syria's new leaders want off the U.S. terrorist list. Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, or HTS, was designated a foreign terrorist organization back in 2018 for using tactics like car bombings, suicide bombings, primarily against the former Assad regime, but sometimes killing even civilians. The group has moved away from those types of activities over the years, and it did break the ties it once had with the Islamic State and Al-Qaeda. None of that has been enough, though, for President Biden. He recently decided to defer to President-elect Trump on whether to remove HTS from the foreign terrorist organization list. But as Aaron Zellin of the Washington Institute for Near East Policy told me, chances are slim it will happen anytime soon.
Post 9/11, there have been five terrorist groups that have gone off the list that are jihadi related, but that only happened years after they were defunct. So if HTS was taken off the list, it would be the first group that was still active that was taken off of the list. At the same time, from a governmental perspective, they don't want to take a step and then the particular group or individual then fall back into past type of actions, and therefore there's a potential political blowback related to this. I don't necessarily think that HTS have an interest in being involved in terrorism anymore, but they still act as an authoritarian government in the areas that they controlled. So my worries would be more about, you know, authoritarianism than terrorism per se.
So what will it take for a group to be undesignated?
It's based off of a review process, essentially, by people in the State Department and Treasury Department. Obviously, lawyers are involved in this, as well as, you know, subject matter experts on this. As far as I'm aware, there's no process right now for HTS to be taken off of the list. My understanding is that sanctions related to the Assad state could come off first, but based off of conversations I've had, the terrorism designation sanction would probably be the last thing that would potentially go. And part of it doesn't even have to do with terrorism per se, but more how this transition goes, whether it's viewed as inclusive of all of Syrian society, and they're seen as acting in, you know, good stewards of Syria and making sure that they're not attacking any neighbors. And so the way it's being framed is that it's a tool that the government is trying to use to try and push the people from HTS in a manner that would be of beneficial interest to the United States as well as its allies in the region.
I wonder, as somebody who studied this group and studied Syria, the consequences of taking them off too early.
I mean, I think one of the issues that many people are worried about is that they'll just potentially go back to the type of tactics that they had previously, and they're kind of let off the hook. Mm. At the same time, we also have this track record now, which suggests that isn't necessarily the case. But to this day, now that they're in control, even if we have seen this transformation in the last 8.5 years, many Syrians are still fearful and also skeptical that, you know, these changes that they say they've made, or at least have shown, you know, whether it was genuine or not.
Many Syrians are skeptical as well.
Yes, exactly. At the same time, there's also potential positive case here that could maybe indirectly affect other groups in other regions that are currently affiliated or maybe have looked at other off-ramps.
Like what?
Like if HTS was taken off the list and they are considered legitimate on some levels, at least in the eyes of the international system, that maybe it would show that there are other opportunities beyond just affiliating oneself to the Islamic State or Al-Qaeda. It doesn't necessarily mean that other groups might do it, but it could provide an avenue where it is possible. And also, it could be a potential model illustrating that the era of the extreme of the extremes maybe is going by the wayside.
Aaron Zellin of the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
The United Nations has moved to formally define and respond to global cybercrime. Some countries, including the United States, have lingering concerns about the terms. NPR cybersecurity correspondent Jenna McLaughlin has more.
While many people around the world were off celebrating winter holidays, the United Nations General Assembly was hard at work, looking to push through policy they'd been working on for the last 5 years.
When everybody else was waiting for Santa to come down the chimney, the UN was passing its five-year cybercrime convention.
That's Alana Cohen. She's in charge of legal and policy issues at cybersecurity firm HackerOne. She and the rest of the cyber community have been keeping a close eye on conversations at the UN, especially after Russia spearheaded talks to come up with the cybercrime agreement back in 2019. There are other international cybersecurity agreements, like the Budapest Convention, but it doesn't have the same global support. The UN set out to define cybercrime itself and figure out ways its members could help each other tackle the problem.
So the underlying purpose of the Cybercrime Convention was a good one. It was to facilitate international cooperation to investigate and prosecute, you know, serious cybercrimes. And that is a cause that everyone can support. But unfortunately, that's about where the consensus collapses, because there are a lot of questions about how they define cybercrime and specifically what a serious crime is under the treaty.
For example, Russia and China might argue that language the U.S. might see as activism or free speech might constitute a serious cybercrime. And it's possible the convention might not protect good faith security researchers who hunt for vulnerabilities in order to fix them, explains Cohen.
So regardless of intent, it makes no distinction between a cybercriminal and somebody who is conducting legitimate security testing and who might not otherwise have explicit permission to do so.
Despite the overly broad language, the UN General Assembly adopted the Cybercrime Convention on Christmas Eve, lauding the steps taken to tackle online abuse, scams, and money laundering. Jonathan Schreiner, who represents the U.S. on the UN's Economic and Social Council, cheered the adoption, but made it clear that the U.S. has remaining concerns about the ambiguity of the convention. He said the U.S. would not allow other nations to use the new treaty as a weapon to violate human rights around the globe. And the process isn't over. There's time before the policy is fully ratified. Cohen and HackerOne hope the U.S. uses that time to push for better protections. Jen McLaughlin, NPR News.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Leila Fadel.
All I need is someone like you. Yes, I